Everyone should have the right to food, but not just any food. Everyone should have access to nutritious, affordable, safe, and sustainable foods. Join us this World Food Day. Support the right to foods for a better life and a better future. Visit www.fao.org.
G'day and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen with the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if you mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, I would like to introduce you to Jessica Burnside, who is doing a Master of Science in Epidemiology under the supervision of Dr. Sahar Saeed. Welcome to Grad Chat, Jessica.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here. Yeah, looking forward to the chat.
That's good. So your research topic is the burden of steatotic liver disease in Canada, sex differences in prevalence and cardiometabolic profiles. Mm-hmm. So before you tell us what all that means.
Yes.
Can you give me some definitions here?
For sure.
For instance, what is steatotic liver disease, for starters?
Yeah. So steatotic liver disease is sort of an umbrella term. So it encompasses a number of subgroups of people with this particular type of liver disease. And all steatosis is referring to is fat accumulation in the liver. Okay. To a certain extent that it then can sort of cause downstream effects, like further damage to the liver. So really, it's just encompassing a number of different what are called etiologies of liver disease, meaning right. how they are developed. So different etiologies of liver disease under the term of steatotic liver disease.
Okay. And I know later on you talk about, what do you mean by cardiometabolic profiles?
Mm-hmm. So as when we start to talk a little bit about some of those etiologies of liver disease, one of them is highly related to metabolic dysfunction in our body. So things
like an imbalance somewhere.
That's right. Yeah. So when we think about when we have conditions like obesity or diabetes, that's often related to metabolic dysfunction. So cardiometabolic is an even broader term.
Not to do with the heart.
It is, yeah, because a lot of the times when we have this dysfunction, cardiovascular disease is one of the main concerns.
Oh, okay, right. Mm-hmm. Is that because of the fatty tissues yeah. that you were talking about?
Yeah, hypertension, highly related, right, so high right. blood pressure.
Which makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Which
so it's just sort of encompasses that hypertension aspect
so
as
well. So
that's
a secondary problem because of this steatotic.
Yeah, well, we might get into that, but there's lots of debate about like the chicken and the egg.
Right.
So is it the liver fat that comes first? Is it sort of other dysregulation that causes the accumulation of fat in the liver? But that's a big debate.
A big debate. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then there's another area here, which I didn't mention in the research topic, but it's something called metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease. Mm-hmm. Or MASLD.
Right.
Which used to be called something else.
Yes. Yes.
So what is that?
Okay.
Which I know you'll explain a little bit more in relation to your work.
Yeah. So steatotic liver disease, we're familiar with that. That's the ending part of the term that you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. Metabolic dysfunction associated is telling us how they got the steatosis in the liver. So it's the most common type of SLD is MASLD. Metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease.
Right.
So yeah, that fat accumulation in the liver up to a point where it accounts for 5% of the liver's weight and highly related to the cardiometabolic dysfunction. So that's the definition of MASLD.
And you mentioned also too, this buildup of fat in the liver often happens with people who have diabetes or high blood pressure, obesity, mm-hmm. those kind of things. Do we have any statistics on that of how many? Because we always talk about when we talk about cancers or this disease and that, one in 10 people in Canada will have blah, 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 or likely have. Is it? Do we have stats and things like that?
Yeah, so that's a very much at the core of my work. Yeah. So global estimates for the prevalence, so how many people have MASLD, pinpointed at about like over 30%. Which is a really significant number of people.
30% of the population.
That's right, yeah.
Have this. Mm-hmm. And I guess, is there more prevalence in one country over another? I mean, is it a Western issue or is it?
So for a long time, I think it was thought that the prevalence was higher in Western countries. But I think the prevalence is quite high globally across the board. Right. And sometimes even in like South Asian countries as well.
Okay, well, that's not good. It's across the board. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Although maybe it'd be easy to figure it out a little bit better.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the interesting things about this topic is most of us haven't heard about the term, and yet it's
so prevalent.
It's very prevalent, yeah.
So I'm just going to recap your research topic again. The burden of steatotic liver disease in Canada, sex differences in prevalence and cardiometabolic profiles. So give us a bit of a background. You know, what are you trying to do there? What was the background of you even going into that topic?
So there hasn't been in epidemiology, you want your prevalence estimates. So how many people have the disease to be what's called generalizable.
Right.
So that means that when you calculate how many people in your study population have the disease, you want that population to be sort of reflective
of the whole population,
so that it can be generalizable to that population.
Right.
So in Canada, we actually, up until this point, haven't really had an accepted prevalence estimate completed. And there's a lot of different reasons why that's been challenging. So one of the reasons is to truly diagnose fat in the liver, it often uses imaging techniques.
Okay.
So liver histology, which would be like a biopsy, is technically the gold standard, but it's not something you could apply in a population level study to people who are otherwise healthy, right? And then even imaging techniques, things like using adapted MRI or even ultrasound, can be quite costly for large studies of people.
Yeah, and so you get a good cross-section
of the population. Mm-hmm. That's right. So this sort of next step down in how we might identify the disease is using non-invasive tests that are based on blood biomarkers.
Okay.
So we look at sort of enzyme levels maybe in your blood.
So when the GP says you need to go and have a blood test, we just go and check a few things out. Usually they mark something on the chart for the people who are testing the blood. But if they don't mark off, are they looking for the fatty whatevers, then it's not going to show up, is it?
Yeah. So there are a couple liver enzymes that your GP may look for in a regular checkup. They're called alanine aminotransferase and aspartate aminotransferase, if
Fantastic.
You're interested. But yeah, those are the types of things that are measured and sometimes included in these scores that we try to calculate based off of a blood test.
But if they're not always marking that off, then it's not going to be recorded, is it? Is it something that they would normally look for? Or because that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, if this is the only cheap method of doing it, then you want them all to do it to get a good breakdown.
So I think what you're sort of referring to is sort of what data source would be good to measure this prevalence. So administrative data in Canada is where our health records are stored.
Okay. Yep.
So there are certain institutions that store your health records, things like what your physician orders would be stored there.
Right.
Now, screening in the general population, so all of us, for steatotic liver disease is not currently recommended.
And why is that when there's 30% prevalence across the globe?
Mm-hmm. So there's a couple of different reasons. One reason is there's a good portion of people with steatotic liver disease who will not progress to the most sort of advanced forms of the disease that would require sort of specialty management of the condition. There, up until this point, haven't been specific treatments for steatotic liver disease approved.
Okay. Right.
So if you screen someone for a disease and then you don't necessarily have a unique treatment for them, it might not be ethical.
Right.
So things like lifestyle modifications are a treatment, but so those are some of the reasons and the cost as well of screening that many people.
But if we know if you look at the people who, for instance, obesity or diabetes, would those people fall into, yes, we should test for this?
You're getting right to it. You're a sleuth. You know the crux of the problem. Yeah. So many international organizations, including the European Association for the Study of the Liver, the American Diabetes Association, have recommended screening for MASLD amongst people with diabetes, type 2 diabetes, because they're a high-risk group.
Right.
And the burden is much higher in that group.
Right. Okay, well, that's good. Okay, so that's the background.
Yes.
All right. Now, exactly what are you trying to do in your research? Because you're looking at Canada and you're looking at sex gender differences.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you looking at that?
Yeah, so I sort of report two measures of burden. So prevalence, which we already discussed, how many people have it. Mm-hmm. Incidence, which would be how many people sort of acquire it over a certain period of time that you're looking at prospectively, looking forward. And then it's important when you're describing this population to not, depending on the factors that you know influence the disease, to not just provide overall general estimates, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, so, geography and everything can have a difference, can't it?
Right. And a really big one in this topic area is the sex difference between males and females.
Right.
And despite that knowledge, a lot of epidemiology studies don't either have the sample size, so that means the number of people in their studies, to provide separate estimates for males and females. And so that was like a driving force for, I was fortunate to have a large enough sample size to do that appropriately. Well,
that's great. Mm-hmm. That's great. So what are the key takeaways that you're finding in the data that you have got to describe, as you mentioned here, the population with MASLD in Canada?
Yeah. So I think we can start with the sort of overall prevalence for males versus females. And when it has been documented that males have a much higher burden of steatotic liver disease. So in my sample, it was about 46% of males versus 24% of females. So almost two times.
Yeah.
Wow. I will mention that the population I was looking at was over the age of 45.
Okay, because I imagine the age would have a significant, well, two things I always think have a significant, well, three, the gender is one, age, and then where you're actually living. I mean, the environment to me has a huge impact when you talk about lifestyle, of the lifestyle part. You know, is this population have more access to unhealthy foods, or only has access to unhealthy foods as opposed to healthy foods, or they can't afford medical attention as the same way, or it's not even available?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're right. So the sex, so males versus females, definitely a big contributor. And then age and how that relates to sex. Menopause is a really big event that affects the burden of this condition. So we all know
about men going through a midlife crisis?
I'm sure.
I don't know how you measure that.
I'm not sure how we measure that. But menopause, we know that there's hormonal changes when that occurs. And for females, estrogens are actually very protective for developing some of these cardiometabolic dysfunction in the body.
Right.
And the reason is because it protects the sort of depositing of fat in your abdominal region, which is more problematic for the liver and some of your other sort of functions related to cardiometabolic health.
Aren't we lucky?
Yes, yes. But menopause, unfortunately, your estrogen levels change. And then after that, you're at much higher risk for this condition and related conditions.
And so if you're looking at the population over the 40s, I mean, you've made the obvious one with a woman going through menopause, the change. But was there really anything else? Anything else that was that could be significant
for that age group? Yeah. Or, I mean, I think there are a number of things. So when we're talking about this type...
Well, I'll put one forward.
Mm-hmm.
When people retire, I like to think the stress levels go down, and maybe that's enough to make changes, because maybe you're spending more time sitting around or eating more than you would if you were at work. I don't know. I'm reaching.
I think a retirement is an interesting event to consider because it could have an effect in a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. So maybe you have more time to exercise, but maybe you also have more time. Like you're in the home, you're not able to regulate your eating in the same type of way.
Right.
But also it can have an impact on people's income. And we know healthy food can be very expensive.
Which I've never understood how healthy food's more expensive than processed food.
Yeah, no, for sure. But this is what you're referring to from the environmental behavioral influences of the disease. Back to where we started, right? Compared to an infectious disease that we transmit to one another, a chronic disease is really a product of like a lifetime's worth of exposures and or ongoing sort of contributors, whether those genetic, environmental, behavioral.
Or not. So from a public health and policy perspective, because at the end of the day, whatever you've collected, you want something to happen with it. It's great collecting it, but we want something to happen. So what would be the next steps in the prevention and management of MASLD and the interrelated cardiometabolic conditions? Now, so I know you've only talked about the gender differences, but what are you expecting to come from all of this? Because clearly you would have gone into this project for two reasons. One, you know, what is the prevalence and why? And if there's differences. And then the second one, well, what are we going to do about it?
Yeah, I think to answer that question, I might have to expand a little bit on some of the key takeaways in terms of the burden. No problem. First, if I could clarify, when I did a sort of sub-analysis to look at gender, which I conceptualized separate from sex. Because sex is sort of referring to our biological attributes that we're born with, and gender is more referring to our, like, social experience, the norms, behaviors, institutionalized power, those types of things. So the sort of one area where I was able to do an exploratory analysis of the effect of gender was actually related to income and its association with MASLD prevalence. So we found when you look overall, the burden of MASLD is higher amongst people with the lowest household income. But when you stratify by sex, which is what we had talked about at the beginning, so that means separate estimates for males versus females, you can see that the relationship between MASLD prevalence and low income is much stronger amongst females compared to males. And so that sort of points to a bit more of a gender effect on who these people
are. Always earning less.
Yeah, and how that affects, and how low income affects disease development potentially differently in males versus females. And that gives us a sense of sort of the gender experience. And then the other key takeaway I might highlight that I think relates to your question, which is, you know, what are the next steps? How can we, like, actionably move forward? Is, unsurprisingly, the extent of sort of metabolic dysfunction amongst the people who have MASLD.
Okay, so what else is going on, basically, you're saying? Other things are happening in the body.
So I looked at the MASLD group and said, okay, how many of these people also have diabetes, also have obesity, also have high lipid levels in their body, also have hypertension? And sort of how, this is sort of the term of comorbidities or multimorbidities, so having more than one sort of disease influencing you at one time. And there was a really high extent of that occurring in this population as well.
So were they having more than one, or they were either diabetic or they had hypertension, or is it a combination? That
It's actually, I would say, about 30%. Sorry, I'll repeat that. About 30%, without knowing the exact number off the top of my head, of people with MASLD had all five cardiometabolic. Yes. So I think it's important to sort of zoom in this way and say, okay, like MASLD is highly prevalent, right? So it affected a number of people. There's differences between males and females. And then there's a subgroup of those people who have a high level of
all the contributing factors.
And so then we start to think about, in terms of public health and policies, how can we target those people? How can we treat multimorbidity, because all these things are interrelated, without being in our silo of people who study liver disease and people who study diabetes, et cetera.
Because if you look at the five things, some people will go, well, let's let's work on diabetes, let's work on hypertension, as you said, singly, as opposed to, well, maybe we need to look at them all together of how we can change that. Because what were the, I don't, you may not know this, but what were the rates of people who only had one or two of those out of the five?
A very low. It was only 1.9% of people with MASLD only had one other.
Right.
And some of that is sort of baked into, one, the definition of the disease requires you to have at least one other.
Right.
And some of these, the score that I was talking about, the blood-based score, to define MASLD also sometimes includes things like your hemoglobin A1C level, which is tells you about your glycemic control, so how well it's used for example, managing in people with diabetes. So some of that is baked in, but I think regardless, it's a really high number of people with all of them. And so in terms of a public health perspective, you know, I'm not a physician, but they've started to come out and emphasize sort of care guidelines for multimorbidity instead of sort of single disease pathways and how to sort of treat and manage those.
That's not easy, because usually it's probably left up to the GP to start with, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if people don't go for annual checkups and, well, first of all, they've got to get a GP. But if they don't have annual checkups, that's going to be a bit of an issue, isn't it?
No, for sure, for sure. And I think also in terms of obesity alone, it's taken a long time for it to even become recognized as a disease itself.
True.
And not just sort of something stigmatized towards personal habits that are modifiable and sort of a disease that instead needs to be diagnosed and treated. And so I think there's a lot of sort of factors that can make this pathway to actually maybe identifying and treating these conditions quite challenging.
I know you said this is a global issue, but and you're looking at the Canadian context, and I'm going back a little bit here. Did you see any differences, if you had enough data, between provinces?
Yeah. So the cohort that I examined was called the Canadian Longitudinal Study on Aging, in case there's any other grad students out there who want to use that data source. It was a great data source. And so to calculate the scores that I require to define steatosis, people had to attend an in-person physical assessment. And these centers were only located in a certain number of the provinces in Canada. So I did look at geographical differences with the caveat that Saskatchewan, for example, and the territories were not...
We're
not part of it.
So you're only... And were most of the ones that were captured from urban areas?
Definitely a limitation, yes. So the Canadian Longitudinal Study of Aging, I should say, does have a bigger cohort of people who do telephone interviews, and they can be from anywhere in the provinces. But because of the data I required, these people did live within 25 kilometers of these collection centers, which does mean that they tended to be healthier, wealthier, more urban than the general population in Canada.
So it could be very different if we were able to do a better collection, which is not for you to have to do. But it's a good question, though, right? Because, I mean, you are limited by the data that you've got. And so, you know, what have you learned about epidemiological approaches to studying diseases that cluster with comorbidities or descriptive epidemiology? And I'm bringing, that's in general, but we are limited by the data.
That's right. Yeah. To comment on that first, I mean, some of the imperfections in the previous studies were part of the rationale for conducting this work. But no study is perfect. And if there's a better data source out there that in future could be used to get a better estimate for this disease incidence, prevalence among certain subgroups, that would be great. One thing I hope that's taken away from my project is some increased awareness and public health momentum, which could lead to, you know, future studies, including the imaging techniques that are required to diagnose it in a different way. But in terms of some of the things I've learned from sort of what we consider a methodological perspective in epidemiology. So how do you actually do this if you wanted to replicate it in a similar context?
Right.
You know, I think the chicken or the egg problem is really challenging because it becomes, are you identifying MASLD or are you identifying sort of the association of a lot of different related parameters, and how do you tease them out separately, diabetes, obesity, when they have similar effects maybe on things like our hemoglobin A1C and how we sort of manage insulin
manage
in our
all
body.
Of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just difficult, isn't it?
Really challenging.
Because I would imagine, I mean, you knew the limitations, mm-hmm. but it need you, some, like you said, you've created at least hopefully an awareness that this is an issue out there in Canada and we don't have good stats on it.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we're seeing with the sample that we've got,
mm-hmm.
But it could be worse. Hopefully it's not, but it could be worse. And in which case, what are we doing about it? Because
mm-hmm.
unless things are highlighted and made and aware, nothing changes.
Yeah.
We just go, oh, that's another stat, but it just fits in that bucket. We don't do anything with that bucket because we don't have time for that bucket. It's not big enough for us to have time.
Yeah.
Wrong way of thinking about it, but that's often what happens, right? Where do you put your resources? You put your resources in those that
Of course,
that
and those
are
practical questions. And even something that comes from a prevalence study like this is now you have data that you could use to do a cost-benefit analysis, for example, in understanding if we did this intervention, which is basically like saying applied maybe a specific program or testing regimen or whatever it may be to try to reduce the burden or treat these people, how much would that cost and what would be the benefit? So without those stats, it makes those types of studies challenging to even understand the effect of a potential intervention in Canada. But I think the other question is something I've wrestled with a lot is talking with friends, you know, ultimately these are just a lot of what my thesis was, and we didn't talk about everything, but was some descriptive stats of like, who are these people? How many?
Right.
And I think trying to understand like, what's the value in that? And I think the value is that, yeah, you need those types of things to start the conversation, to keep the conversation going.
Right.
And I think this type of epidemiology is often more digestible for the general public.
Well, it's not something that's immediate, right? Like when we had COVID, mm-hmm. it affected everybody, but this is still just as important before it gets to become epidemic proportions.
Right. And I think while the terminology is heavy in this topic, right, MASLD, SLD, there's more. I think, you know, understanding, you know, what percentage of people does this affect?
Right.
Who are they? I think is something that can translate to people who might not be liver specialists but are still in the health community or even broader than
and
that.
And what can we be doing to keep the fattiness out of our livers?
Our livers. yes.
We don't want to be weighing down our livers. They do extremely important things.
Yeah.
And we've got to look after them.
The liver is a special organ. It has a crazy ability to regenerate. And
well, I wonder what else you're right. The liver is an amazing organ. And, you know, what else can this organ tell us about, you know, when we go in and do little biopsies on it and things? I'm sure it can tell us an awful lot.
I would imagine so, because it's involved in sort of detoxification of our bodies. And
which is where it used to be called non-alcohol, whatever, wasn't it, in the liver?
Yeah.
Which was weird to even put the word alcohol in if it wasn't affected by alcohol. So.
Oh, yeah. No, that's right. So they changed the language in 2023. And part of the reason is because they didn't know back when they first identified the disease what was causing it. So they defined it by what wasn't causing
it. What wasn't.
So it's called negative diagnostic criteria.
Oh, well, that doesn't help sometimes.
Yeah. So
people just remember one word. They forget the non in front.
Yeah. And so I think when we talk about, is this the right moment to be talking about MASLD? I think there is a lot of public health momentum because we have new terminology that might be easier to understand. Although the abbreviations are long, it's maybe a bit clearer as to exactly what this condition is.
Well, good luck with all of that.
Thank you.
I think that's awesome that you're back in town and you're able to sort of keep going to particularly if you are passionate about this and you've got other aspirations too. So good luck with all that, Jessica.
I appreciate it. I appreciate the platform to chat with you today. It was great.
No worries at all. I love it, as you know. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ, signing off with a big hooray.
Sego.
Buju Anim.
Danach A. At Anzeni Shukwithan.
Tanse.
Ei, Inuhadike.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Tanse, I'm Michael Hutchinson, your host for the Cree episodes of Words and Culture. I come from a large family with five boys and two girls, so I was never encouraged to go into hockey because it was too expensive. But my grandpa loved it, and I remember him watching the games and getting all excited depending on the fortunes of his favorite teams. I enjoy watching a good hockey game, but as a former media person, I like watching the camera shots and hearing the commentary too. It's not an easy thing to do, which is why I wanted to talk to Earl Wood. Earl is a musician, powwow MC, and a Cree commentator for NHL hockey games on APTN. Let's meet Earl.
Earl Wood at Sigasano, not Scopuno, Che, why, Nanasco Mona, Semi no Muta. I said, hello, and my name is Earl Wood, and I'm from the Satellite Cree Nation, and I'm very pleased and I'm grateful to be invited here to communicate and talk about our language. Mistami nagi pe ka egi a kuatagito egi pe a nistami nagi pe ke gacha wanita ne ugo and nanasko manas anutska gi sagat a chipugu mute a kame mo ya ka ko ne hiawe ya I'd like to reiterate by saying my name is Earl and regarding the language, I'm unlike all my other relatives. I'm the same as them regarding our interruption to self regarding the language. As an Indigenous person, I believe that our language is paramount to the identity of who we are. As Indigenous people, we all have that. We all have that collective genetic memory, that collective genetic bond. So it's in our blood, it's in our DNA, but it was interrupted and it went dormant. And as a result, we see the many different the effects of that. However, the language is there. And in today's technological reality that we have to exist in as Indigenous people, the Creator gave us something, all of us. And he gave it to us all equally. And he skipped no one. And it was our intelligence. Our intelligence was our evolutionary protection. And the language was a paramount part of that. There's things that happen in the communities now that that are catalysts for the language. But on an everyday basis, in any reservation, you predominantly hear English. You don't really hear a lot of our language. Eh? That's why stuff like Hockey Night in Canada and Cree and all these, using these mainstream, these things that our people are interested in, in this modern day society, see our language can fit right in there. And when you listen to Hockey Night in Canada and Cree, right, it's so descriptive, the language, and it's humorous, right? And it brings it to a whole nother level of understanding and appreciation for Indigenous people. It's a reclamation. And it also stands as a testament to the resilience and the fortitude and the strength and the spirit of the language and the importance of it. Within the language lies values, values that are going to help us.
Welcome one more time. Hockey Night in Canada and Cree on APTN. The world's greatest network to Scott's Night Blonde. Minawuta, our linguist, Jason Chemakis, with a little bit of language resources. How, Jason?
Okay. Utilma, over in Calgary, we have some...
I asked Earl how he got involved with interpreting NHL games in Cree.
So I became a chuck wagon announcer, a race announcer. And then I became a rodeo announcer. And then I became a Indian relay announcer. So that was, and that was connected to the culture, horses, and language. And I use language. Every time I MC, I put the language in there. And, you know, the people, they respond. Both Indigenous and non-Indigenous, you know. People come up and ask, what do you say? And I always say over the mic what I'm saying so everybody can understand, you know, like that. So this guy phoned me up one day out of the blue, Doug Howe. We've since become friends. He phoned me up and says, hey, would you like to, you know, we have an opportunity here. Would you like to send in a demo? My daughter, Fawn, she said, Dad, make one. Go ahead, send it in. So I sent it in, not thinking anything. Then I got this call, right? Yeah, I remember. And then I thought, geez, you know what? There's one thing I can say I helped out in. I played one small part in that storm of cultural awakening. You know, yeah. I think there's a storm of coherency happening within the people. And I think there's a way that, and to be creative, there's a way we can use technology to help us. I don't think we ever lost it. I think it was just like making a sweat fire. You start out small sometimes, and then all of a sudden that fire is real hot. Then you go sweat, and then you realize how good it is to do all these things in process and stay focused. And Wakutuin, we need to have that, these words. That's why those words are important. Wakutuin, you know, when we cared about each other. Wakutuin is a whole one word, but it means a whole bunch of things. Being related, being relative, and honoring each other like that, and looking after that relationship.
Was hockey a big part of your life growing up?
Yeah, we used to play on the sloughs. We used to play on the back here. There's a creek that goes by, and everybody would go there and play hockey. Yeah, hockey was always a big part of it. Even in residential school, they had hockey.
Yeah.
I remember playing hockey there, and they let us go out on the ice, and that was a good time. Every now and again, man, you'd forget where in the heck you were. Just be skating and be like that, and you know, okay, come on in. Then the reality would come back. Yeah. Hockey was always a big part. I remember we had great big tournaments, and people were, you know, it was a gathering. It was a way of gathering people. I remember that there was lots of good hockey, outside hockey too, right? No. Yeah. They didn't have these arenas and that. They had outside hockey.
So, man, Squats tournaments, hockey tournaments, me nekagisigatina, no? Nicola Valley Junior Hockey Tournament, March 2024, Merritt, BC. Gakyo, kintam go
now,
ekne, kanto, sito, squay,
go, wagumagando, agekne, Merritt, BC. Now you're an NHL sportscaster, you know, like... How does that make you feel that you're part of something so big? And like you said, it's a modern expression of the language.
It's like anything we do in life. If it makes you feel good, then you do more. And for me, when I never really understood the whole impact of it, right? Because it was all nervous and stuff going up to the first show and stuff. But when I got home, there was young people in there, you know, oh, there's that guy. He lives here. Hey, he said, hey, that's it. And they come back and they say the word that they, you know, Bimutagil, Bitoel, he scores. And he's getting saying that, and they're saying, how do you say this? How do you say that? And, you know, I seen, and it made me feel, holy smokes, what a beautiful experience it is to have some sort of a part of having an impact on somebody like that, especially regarding giving them something that is going to help them get to center and help them identify themselves and be comfortable with themselves, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of finding pieces of yourself and holy smokes, oh, there's a piece of me I didn't know it, and here it is, right? And you put it back on, or you put it back on and you wear it. It felt like that, you know. Yeah. It feels like that here, because a lot of our young people, boys, they don't speak the language, and they're always on their phones and just, but they all like hockey, okay? Especially now with the women's hockey. Right? Yeah. These young girls, right? And and they identify with me being that hockey guy, right? So we talk. I go to the schools and we talk, you know. You girls too, and those guys, hey, can I, you think I could be a commentator? Of course you could be a commentator. You could get a guy on a camera. You could be running the camera. You could be the director. You know, you tell them these things, right? Yeah. So it's, you know, it really feels good. Eh? I felt really humbled. I felt really proud. And as for me, my own personal journey, I felt like, you know, all the things that we witnessed as kids in the boarding school and stuff, you know, you could use that stuff to help others, you know, help these young people, you know, learn from the past, look at the past. Look at what your uncles and your aunties and your Muslims, and look where they wanted you to go. Look what they left you. This language will take you anywhere you want to go.
In being a commentator, you've had to create new words to be able to describe what's going on in the games. Can you tell us some of those words that you've created to be able to do your commentary?
Well, I don't know if it's like creating a different word more so than looking at it from a different lens.
Mm.
Looking at it from a different lens. It's just a little bit different focus like that. And, from a different view, even, right? Because the language is very descriptive, you know? And one word could mean a sentence or it could mean a whole happening. Right? And with that language, sometimes the guy will fall down, right? He'll get checked down, he'll get a kind of up slow. And Clarence will say something regarding, oh, he's getting up like you when you hit a moose, and he gets back up and he kind of wobbles around, right? So there's a lot of comedy like that. But, you know, as an Indigenous person, I could just tell, you know, who really keys in is these old people that know the language. You know, to listen to Clarence, if you really understand the language, he takes you on a journey. You're watching this hockey game, but the metaphors just take you on a journey. In and out of that arena, man, and out into the vast expanses of universal thought. And it also helps you when you listen to him. It gives you an opportunity to allow yourself for some introspection. And it also challenges some of your worldview. And I think we need to be challenged like that because we need to evolve. Our language needs to evolve. The way we use the language, the understanding of the language needs to evolve. The way we teach it, it needs to evolve. And then it's like bringing home a nice hind quarter, but you're chipping it off as you get home. And then pretty soon when you get home, you don't have anything left. All these guys that are branching out and teaching the language, because the language can be changed and it could be, there's a word I'm trying to use here that would just hit it right on the head. But it's kind of like when you you could change it a little bit just by with the sound, right? And all of a sudden that word still sounds the same, but it's not grammatically correct. Here's an example, right? Now, I'm not saying this is wrong, but I'm saying how languages can be diluted. But if you try to teach the Plains Cree dialect, and you change it just a little bit, and you put the Y dialect in there, even in one word, right? You're going to teach somebody that. They're going to go away thinking that is this dialect when it's that dialect. Mm-hmm. So I think important for us, there was a time where we knew who we were, we knew what we were saying, and we knew our purpose. Then this language, other language came in, and this other spiritual belief came in. And all of a sudden we were like this, and now we're like this. Sometimes we say things and we don't use that language properly. Right? So there's some miscommunication. And then all of a sudden these young people going away, and that language took a little curve, and those young people are holding it like that. So they're going to teach people with that curve. Okay? So for me, you know, it would be good if we could collectively, as indigenous people, and these people, the powers that be, and they are, you know, there's all kinds of associations, right, that represent us. You know, where's that Mamo Kamatu, and where's that working together? Where is that Wakutu, and where is that all our relations? They're not thinking of it. We should all have a collective language database, and we should all be moving forward together to fortify and replenish all the languages, not just the Cree language.
I'm going to have more with Mr. Earl Wood a bit later in the show. I'm really interested in the future of the Cree language and how it can evolve over time, and how new words can be created as our world changes. Language reclamation and the future of Indigenous languages comes in many forms, from calling hockey games to singing contemporary songs. Art Napoleon has a master's in language revitalization. He is a language educator and may be best known for his TV show Moose Meat and Marmalade. But Art is also a musician, and he's kind of ahead of his time. In 2010, Art Napoleon released an album called Creelin Covers, where he translated some pop songs into Cree. This is his version of Tracy Chapman's song, Talking About a Revolution.
Keep a wee person.
Was Art Napoleon and talking about a revolution. The NHL has been doing some pretty cool things to honor Indigenous culture. Each season during a Winnipeg Jets game, the NHL partners with the Winnipeg Aboriginal Sports Achievement Center, or WASAC. Indigenous musicians and dancers come out and perform before and during the game. This year, the Jets invited Cree mezzo-soprano Rhonda Head to sing the national anthem in her language.
My name is Rhonda Head. I'm from Apaskwak Cree Nation, Manitoba, in Treaty 5 territory. I'm a recording artist, author, singer, songwriter. I am not fluent in Cree, but I understand quite a bit. But my parents didn't teach me Cree because of residential school. So I started, I was taking voice lessons and I was learning Italian and French and Latin, and I was becoming really good at singing in those languages, and I kind of put a stop to it. I'm like, wait a minute, I should be singing in my own language. So that's when I started writing songs in a Cree language, and my language started coming back to me. And what I found too, writing in Cree, was that Cree is also a language of love because it fit perfectly with the Italian words of an opera, as well as French and Latin, and it just flowed beautifully. So I call the Cree language also a language of love. I probably rehearsed the anthem more than 1,000 times. I rehearsed it, singing it, and I rehearsed it in my head. It was such an incredible moment. I prepared hours and hours of meditating, of visualizing, of going through the song over and over in my head. Like, I knew I could nail the songs, but it was the amount of people that were going to be in that arena. My favorite hockey team was going to be there and listening to me live right there on the ice. And I knew it was going to be televised. So that's what I needed to prepare for. So I could nail the songs perfectly. And then when I got onto the ice, I was very calm and confident, and it just felt so, after I was done singing the anthem, it just felt really like a lot of pride. And I sang my heart out and with lots of feeling. And it was just an incredible moment, probably one of the most pivotal moments of my career. I wanted to sing the anthem in Cree because actually it's the first song I've sung in public. That was the first song I sang in front of an audience at the OCN Blizzard, and I sang the Canadian anthem in Cree. It's so beautiful. It's a beautiful rendition of O Canada. The anthem in Cree is different from the anthem in English, and what I'm singing about is the sacredness of the land and how we love the land. When I started learning the song and I asked for the translation of the song, they pretty well told me I'm singing about the sacredness of the land of like Canada, how sacred the land is. My favorite part is actually all of it, because I get to sing about our land and on how we interpret the Canadian anthem in English to Cree. To me, it has more meaning because we are, as Indigenous people, like being part of the land is part of who we are as people. After I sung the anthem, I just felt an overwhelming sense of relief, for one thing, for nailing it, and overwhelming sense of pride. And because we've come a long way as a nation from being stopped from learning our language and being punished for talking in our language to singing in our language at a National Hockey League game. It's quite incredible. It was quite special, and I had my social media blew up right after that, right after I sang, me and my sister went walking around in the levels there when they were having intermission, and I got approached by a lot of Caucasian people telling me how great I sang and what a wonderful performance I did. And so that felt really good. Like, that to me, that was some like reconciliation.
That was Rhonda Head, a citizen of the Opaskwayak Cree Nation in northern Manitoba. All right, before we go, I asked my first guest, Earl Wood, to share some Cree words with me.
Relations. Relatives. The relationship with the trees, with the water, with the earth, with the people, and all our relatives on this earth. Wakutuin. Mamokamatuin. Means work together. Working together. But within that, it's taking that personal responsibility to that collective. Sakituin. Love. It means kaipume. Agme mo. Pakteita mo. That word means a lot. Just as some of it, kaipume. Don't give up. Agme. Try hard. Pakteita mo. Teita mo. To be able to forgive. Don't be a prisoner to the trauma. Release yourself. Release that person who caused the trauma. You'll be both free from it. It's energy. Because we as Indigenous people, we realize we live in a vibratory reality. We're spiritual beings having a physical spiritual experience. Because the rocks have spirit, the trees have spirit, the water. Whatever happens to the trees and waters can happen to us. I tell that to all the kids every time I talk. And the connection and the spirit that they have to those. The spirit. Look after your spirit. Because we're living in a time where spirits are getting eaten.
Well, that's it. The past 6 episodes of Words and Culture and their focus on the Cree language has been an awesome journey for me. I always enjoy talking to my Auntie Stella, but other language warriors like Grand Chief Satie, Ron Cook, Adrian Sutherland, Richard Keeper, and of course Earl Wood were also great to speak with and learn from. Ultimately, a people's worldview is in their language, and I think the Cree worldview still has a lot to offer humanity. The very idea of splitting all of creation into that which has